Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
A moment of truth for the Democrats. Will it be a moment of reckoning for the president? We discuss the push towards impeachment amid the Ukraine scandal. Then...
Sounds a little like a mea culpa. It sounds a little like a...
I think it should sound a lot like a mea culpa.
In an exclusive interview, I speak to Uber's embattled CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, as he insists the model still works after the company blows through billions in just 3 months. Plus,
I found making this film probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
The director of the Oscar-winning documentary White Helmets tells us about his most challenging project yet, confronting his own brother's suicide on camera. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in New York. Today, a pivotal moment in U.S. history. For only the fourth time in 151 years, an American president is the subject of impeachment proceedings. The White House has released the Memorandum of Record, as it's known, for the now infamous phone call between Donald Trump and the president of Ukraine. It confirms that the president urged Ukraine to investigate the son of former Vice President Joe Biden, who is Trump's top rival for the presidency in 2020. After wrestling with the impeachment question for nearly a year, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced yesterday that Democrats will begin a formal impeachment inquiry on this Ukraine scandal. At stake, unclear right now, but it does come in the midst of a presidential election campaign in an already bitterly divided and polarized nation. Here's President Trump in his own defense this morning.
Just so you understand, it's the single greatest witch hunt in American history, probably in history, but in American history. It's a disgraceful thing. The letter was a great letter, meaning the letter revealing the call. That was done at the insistence of myself and other people that read it. It was a friendly letter. There was no pressure. The way you had that built up, that call, it was going to be the call from hell. It turned out to be a nothing call.
Now, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, he is basking in an unwelcome limelight because of this scandal, and he has also weighed in about that call.
Nobody can put pressure on me because I'm the president of an independent Ukraine. There's only one person who can pressure me, and it's my six-year-old son.
Joining me now from Los Angeles to discuss all the latest developments is the former California Senator Barbara Boxer. And here with me in the studio is the former federal and state prosecutor Ellie Honig. Welcome both of you to the program. Let me just first turn to you for the legal facts, Ellie, and then we're going to get some of the politics from Senator Boxer. What do you make of the transcript that has come on, actually a memorandum of record of this call? Right. Do you see the sort of smoking gun that the Democrats feel is there?
It's pretty darn close to a smoking gun, Christiane. So a couple things. The big picture, what jumps out at me about this memorandum is you can see clearly that President Trump has one purpose in this phone call. He's not calling on a variety of matters. It's not a diplomatic call. It's not an international relations call. He wants help from the Ukrainian president in digging up political dirt on two of his political rivals, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton. And when you get down into sort of the nuances, I do see potential federal crimes here. I see potential bribery, potential extortion, and potential receipt of foreign election aid, all of which are federal crimes. But keep in mind, you do not need a crime in order to impeach. Impeachment can and historically has been based on abuse of power.
Okay, so let's take it slowly with the paragraphs from this transcript. First of all, in the relevant area, President Zelensky says, I would also like to thank you for your great support in the area of defense. We are ready to continue to cooperate for the next steps. Specifically, we're almost ready to buy more javelins from the United States for defense purposes. Now, Trump responds immediately, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. And then the U.S., as we know, froze. The Trump administration froze over the summer hundreds of millions of dollars worth of aid, of military aid. So just from those two graphs, what do you make of it?
Yeah, that is as close to a quid pro quo as you will get in real life. I've charged and tried bribery cases on less clear conversations than this. They're both laying the stakes out on the table. The president of Ukraine says your aid, foreign aid, is invaluable to us. We need it for our defense, and we're getting ready to buy more equipment from the United States. And then Donald Trump's response, this is the most important line in the whole thing. Right after that, Donald Trump says, I would like you to do us a favor, though. So I'm laying it on the line. And what's that favor? There's no mincing words. I want you to look into Hillary Clinton. I want you to look into the Bidens.
Okay, we're going to get to the Biden graph in a moment. But first, yes. I want to go to Senator Boxer, who is a longtime former senator now, a longtime senator, a close colleague of Nancy Pelosi. And you're very obviously well aware of the politics that's going on. Let me play. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you whether you are surprised that having sat on, I guess, the fence, maybe not the right word, but Nancy Pelosi is famous for not wanting to go the impeachment route. She was sort of holding off the most virulent pro-impeachment members of her caucus. And yesterday, she basically said, now we've got to start this inquiry. What do you make of her position? Is she being pushed into it? Or do you believe this is the right thing at the right time?
I know Nancy for so many years, since the 1980s, and I can tell you she doesn't get pushed into anything. This is so serious, and I am so pleased that your guest looked at this and saw it, frankly, the way I see it as a non-lawyer. And that is, when you say these words, and I wrote them down, I would like you to do us a favor, though. Right after this talk about the military aid, it's pretty obviously, to me, a quid pro quo. But, you know, frankly, just the relationships between the two parties here, the powerful one with all the money, you know, Trump, and the supplicant who needs this funding in order to defend against, guess who? Vladimir Putin and Russia. This is very clearly on its face. You know, if it wasn't so explicit, it still would be implicit. So this is a moment in time. It's very serious. I sat through an impeachment about a president lying about having sex. This is a betrayal of our national security, because I was in the Senate and very strongly supported giving aid to the Ukraine against Russia. And Congress had voted for this, all sides, Republicans and Democrats. And he was holding up the aid. Trump was holding up the aid. Last point I'd make at this moment is that when Trump says there's a witch hunt, yeah, and the witch hunt is what he's doing to Joe Biden and his son. And everybody who's looked at this has said that Biden and Obama and all the rest drove out the corrupt prosecutor. So this is on its head upside down. And I just hope justice will be done.
I want to quote another part of this letter, and this is where President Trump specifically raises the issue of Joe Biden. So I'm going to ask you, Ellie, to weigh in on this. He says in this call on July 25th, there is a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General of the United States would be great. Biden was around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. So if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me. So Senator Boxer has just explained what the Obama-Biden aim was, and that was to get rid of corrupt prosecutors and to have reform in the judicial process of Ukraine. And America was helping and giving money, just as the EU was. What do you make of this, the hard turn towards Biden? And I counted four times that President Trump in this call mentioned both Rudy Giuliani and the U.S. Attorney General Barr. as he wanting them to get involved with President Zelensky on this.
That to me is one of the big surprises from this call, that the Attorney General of the United States is involved in this, or the president expects him to be involved. What on earth, what possible legitimate role could the chief prosecutor of the United States have in trying to dig up political dirt on the president's allies? And also, Rudy Giuliani is on sort of the other extreme. He is a private citizen. He's a civilian. He has no role in our federal government. He's not a part of the Department of State or Justice. So why is he involved?
Because he's the president's personal lawyer.
Exactly. And to me, it supports the inference that the whole idea here is to benefit the president personally and politically.
Can I just at this point say, what do we know about the accusations against Biden and his son? Apparently, so far, I mean, there's nothing. There's no there.
Yeah, there seems to be nothing to it. It seems that based on all the reliable reporting that's out there, the goal here was what Donald Trump has claimed his goal was, but it's not supported by this call. But the goal that Biden had was to clean up a corrupt prosecutor and to clean up corruption within the Ukraine. Now, Donald Trump tried to say yesterday, in the course of his evolving defenses, one of the things I was trying to do was clean up corruption. But that is nowhere to be found in this transcript.
And interestingly, Senator Boxer, I assume you've read this memorandum, this transcript. But the president and this new Ukrainian president essentially trash the American ambassador at the time. And the president says, you know, things are going to happen around her. And they also talk about CrowdStrike, which appears to be some kind of conspiracy that somehow the Ukrainians are in possession of that famous Hillary Clinton email server. I mean, he's actually bringing that up on this call as well, something that is a conspiracy theory.
Well, Donald Trump cannot quit Hillary Clinton. Let's be clear. You know, he can't get over the fact that she got so many more votes than he got, even though he's sitting in the Oval Office because of the Electoral College. We all understand that. But the bottom line is, if you really look at this transcript, if you look at this, and, you know, frankly, I'm amazed that they actually let it go. And I'm sure there's more that's even worse. You see kind of a mob boss here. That's the way he runs it. He wants his Roy Cohns, and he has Giuliani, who is, to me, the most corrupt person. He lies, and when he realizes, oops, maybe someone caught that, he backtracks, and he tries to get ahead of all these stories, and then he's trying to get the Attorney General to be his second Roy Cohn. And this is so dangerous. So, frankly, as you look at what our founders wanted to protect us from, you've got it in the person of Donald Trump. Okay, Abuse of power every day, using the office to benefit himself, using every tool at his disposal that he has, whether it's legal or not, to absolutely slime his opponents. And, of course, Joe Biden has been the one he's most afraid of.
Okay, so it is said by CNN and other sources that the president was very surprised, having immediately rushed under pressure to release this transcript, which is not a transcript necessarily of an actual call, but the best recollection, memorandum of report on this, and was very surprised after a phone call with Nancy Pelosi that she then went ahead and made that call yesterday for the impeachment proceedings. We know what the Democrats think. I want to play you a little bit about what Mitt Romney, Republican, now senator, former presidential candidate, said about this today in Washington.
There's just the question of, and I said this in my first reaction, which is, if the president of the United States asks or presses the leader of a foreign country to carry out an investigation of a political nature, that's troubling.
So quickly, before I get to you, Senator Boxer, I want to ask you, the more information is going to come out if and when we hear what the so-called whistleblower who started all this has to say. What are you waiting to hear from him?
Yeah, so we don't know yet. There are a lot of details around this. Let's remember, this phone call that we have this recording or transcript of is only part of the picture. I want to know what led up to this. Were there prior communications? What was Rudy Giuliani doing out there? He's talked about it a bit publicly. What was the fallout from this? And I think the senator made a good point when she said this is sort of how mob bosses talk. One of the things I did as a prosecutor, I know mob bosses. I prosecuted mob bosses. The only difference to me is mob bosses tend to be a bit more subtle when they make a demand. This is just right out in the open.
And Senator Boxer, finally, and we really only have a few seconds, what do you make of a top Republican now saying what he did? You heard what Mitt Romney said. Everybody's been saying that, you know, an impeachment is just another poisonous, partisan, divisive procedure in this wounded country, and that, you know, unless all sides, like they did around Nixon, get together, this is just going to go down the typical political divide. What do you think Republicans might do?
Well, if you love this country, and I assume they do, you love the Constitution. And if you love the Constitution, you understand that we have to protect ourselves against a tyrant, a king, someone who abused power every day. I just want to give a shout out to that inspector general, a Trump appointee who put his career on the line, his reputation and everything else, and stood up for the truth. And I am so grateful to the whistleblower and to the IG.
It's really interesting. And of course, this is just the beginning. We're going to be reporting this for a long time to come. Senator Boxer, Eli Honig, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thanks.
So, if you think the president is embattled, spare a thought for the CEO of one of the world's most revolutionary and also embattled companies. Uber has radically changed the way we travel, the way we socialize, the way we eat, and the way we work. But given the challenges facing the company, CEO Dara Khosrowshahi has certainly set himself a tough task to smooth the company's route ahead since he took over 2 years ago. Uber has lost more than $5 billion in just 3 months this year and has seen its stock tumble since going public in May. Now, I sat down with Khosrowshahi for a frank and exclusive interview about the ubiquity of Uber and the future of its business model. Dara Khosrowshahi, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So, you know, this could be an exercise in beating up on you. Uber is the company people love to hate. Let me just read a little bit from Farhad Manju in the New York Times. Should Uber be kneecapped for its long history of flouting the law, or can it possibly be reformed? Or am I a credulous dolt for even suggesting redemption for one of the sorriest companies ever to emerge from Silicon Valley's tortured hothouse?
So that's one person's opinion.
Well, you know.
But I'll tell you, we have come from a phase in our development where it was all about growth at all costs. And Uber did challenge the authorities because it strongly felt at the time that the authorities were wrong. They were trying to keep the systems as they were and not allow innovation to prosper, not allow truly new ideas to grow. That started, I think, from a good place. But I think it went too far. And the kind of challenger became powerful, and with power came, you know, the belief that you're always right. With power maybe came too much proudness. And we went from, I think, a constructive challenger to a destructive challenger at times. And that required a change, you know, a lesson, a painful lesson. There was a change in leadership, change in leadership of the board. I came on board, and I'm still in the process.
Sounds a little like a mea culpa. It sounds a little like a...
I think it should sound a lot like mea culpa. Listen, I don't want to beat around the bush. We went too far. And we grew in a way that, whereas originally, idealistically, it was in concert with where society needed to go, the growth changed. And it became about grabbing power. It came about the leverage that we were able to create in negotiations, let's say, with regulators. And the fact is that our business is dependent on the streets in which we drive and the cities in which we operate. And we do have to follow the law, and we do have to work constructively with the mayors of the cities in which we operate. We may disagree on many, many points, but ultimately we are a citizen of the cities in which we operate, and we do have to respect that.
So, you know, you talk about having gone too far. Again, some describe it, this article and others, it was like a deliberate insurgent campaign to flout the law and regulations and sort of a, you know, this was before your time. And now, as you know, a new book is out, Super Pump by Mike Isaac, and it paints a pretty ugly picture of the unfettered corporate raiding culture, so to speak. So there are new suggestions and laws that have been put in, for instance, in California. Let's take the whole gig economy, which Uber personifies. Mm-hmm. saying that your drivers, your employees need to be treated like human beings, need to be treated like employees with all the attendant rights and regulations. I think you oppose that, right?
We oppose the law. We don't oppose the idea. Let me be specific here. The traditional view of work, which is you have a full-time job, you only work for one company in your life, that idea is outdated, right? I think now work used to be about the company. You work at IBM, that's your career, et cetera. We think work should be about work, about what you want to do, when you want to do it. And that's the new way of work, which is independent work or so-called gig work. And we do think that just the society's expectations have changed. We should change the nature of independent work. So it should come with protections. It should come with health services. It should come with representation on your having a right to a voice, etc. But it shouldn't, that idea of being independent, having the power to say, I want to work today, I don't want to work the next day, I want to work tonight, during the day I want to go on a picnic, that should not be destroyed. And I think that the law, which we don't think applies to us, this latest law,
You don't
should,
think it applies to you?
Well, we think that we will pass under the test of the law, right? So the law, of course, applies, but we don't think that the law, as it relates to us, would classify our drivers as full-time workers. But at the same time, we do think that the nature of independent work should change.
Because, you know, to follow up, the California state senator, she has said, let's be clear, there's nothing innovative about underpaying someone for their labor. I mean, you indicate that you agree with that, but you don't think this law applies to Uber in all its...
We think that under AB 5, our workers are independent workers, okay?
But they have to fix their own cars. They have to buy their own cars. They don't get vacations. They don't get health. They don't get...
Listen, they get vacations because they can do whatever they want, right? So they don't... The traditional kind of, yes, I've got to go get a vacation. I've got to ask managers...
Health care and all the rest of it, insurance.
Well, that's, exactly. So we have offered all that up. We do believe that they should get health care. We do believe that they should have minimum earnings. And we want to have... We want them to have a voice, and we have come to the table with an offer to exactly reference the issues, minimum pay, health care, the right to have a voice, and by the way, they can take vacation whenever they want. So we think this is the best of both worlds, and we think that trying to fit our model into the old construct of work, which is one job only, one company only, is actually not the right solve for society.
Right. I mean, it's not necessarily one job only, one company only. It's treating workers as workers and human beings rather than, you know, what's happening with the gig economy. And some people say, I mean, it's kind of what you're saying, it's possible that if that happens with the drivers, I mean, you know, Uber might collapse.
Yeah, but I object to that. I think that we're treating our workers as human beings. Right. I think the number one reason why our drivers like Uber is because they have complete control and autonomy to do what they want when they want. So I think these characterizations are characterizations with a political agenda. I don't agree with them. When I go out and meet with our workers, they are entrepreneurs. They know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what they're earning. And I think this idea that they as individuals are below because they don't have full-time jobs, it's just false.
Can I ask you something? You know, I'm not a business person or an entrepreneur. I'm not even really a business reporter. But I do understand the bottom line and how you have to have a profit. It looks like you have to subsidize a lot of Uber activities in order to let it happen. You're not turning a profit. And your recent IPO, which started very high, somewhere around 120, went down to half that value. How sustainable is the model?
We think the model is absolutely sustainable. Now, we're in the early stages of building this model. The business, for example, is still growing 30%+ on a global basis. And anytime you have a business that has the kind of market size of trillions of dollars in terms of transportation and food and local commerce, it makes sense for a company to invest. The goal for us to go public was to raise significant capital, and now we have all the capital we need to go from a period of investment to a period of profitability. But that's absolutely going to take time.
Why do you think, I mean, Uber and the City of London was a big issue over the last several years, whether it was licenses, et cetera. And now they've given you, I think, a two-month extension. They've just ruled, rather than the year or so they gave you the last time this was under debate. It doesn't sound like a massive vote of confidence, 2 months instead of a year. How do you read that?
I think I read it that we're still in the trust building phase as it relates to London, as it relates to society. I first heard about London not finding us fit and proper a few weeks into my job, right? And I flew out there and I met with TfL and I met with authorities. And there had been a profound loss of trust there. And there's a saying which is, trust is lost by the bucketful, you earn it back by the drip. We're earning back our trust. And I'm confident that with work, we will earn our trust back with TfL. In many ways, our goal in London is to be the model citizen out there. We actually have now a target by 2025 to move all of our fleet to be fully electric. We're charging a surcharge in London for every single trip that will go and fund a fund that will allow our drivers to change their cars from kind of traditional gas-burning cars to electric cars. So we think that London with time will be the model market that will appreciate Uber, but we've got to earn that appreciation, and I think we're not done.
So you just raised the idea of electric. Obviously, climate, the environment is huge. Where do you stand on, you know, the environment and actually having to really step up now? Not just a little bit here and there, but really step up. I mean, you know, transport is one of the major polluters, as we know.
Yeah, I think we have to be a part of the solution, and we have to be a lead in the solution. And for us, the electrification of the fleet is one part of the solution. A significant number of our driver partners use hybrid cars. It makes sense. So on average, our fleet is more efficient, I think, than the world fleet. And we're investing very aggressively in technologies like Uber Pool that get more than one person in a car. There's no reason if you're going from one place to another not to have another passenger. So we're investing in Pool as well. And a new area where we're putting hundreds of millions of dollars in is actually individual electric vehicles. These are e-bikes, scooters, et cetera. We have the e-bikes in London now. And it's a great way of getting around, and it's a great way for individuals to get around.
Look, you are fairly new to this job. You did come after a highly contentious chairmanship by Travis Kralnick. You've seen the new book that's come out. I mean, just a very ugly, predatory corporate culture. I know that some of your mentors, people like Barry Diller and others, basically thought you were crazy, completely nuts to take on this job. Larry Ellison, the head of Oracle, has said Uber raises capital to gain market share. The business they secure is not sticky. He noted Uber doesn't own its cars, doesn't control drivers. They have an app my cat could have written.
Apparently, Mr. Ellison has a very talented cat. You know, maybe we should hire him or something like that.
But what is the software? It's drivers and cars. What is the secret sauce?
The secret sauce is the network, okay? It costs enormous amounts of capital, feet on the street in order to go out and bring on this thousands of independent drivers to log onto the network on a regular basis, and then riders who for whom we become an everyday use case. Wake up and take an Uber to work or take an Uber to your dinner. And the dynamic matching of that supply and demand and then coming up with the right choice. So, for example, in London, soon in New York, we will be able to match you not only with a car, but with a pool, with a bike, with a transit system as well. For example, London Transit, the underground buses, all of those are offered in a real-time basis, priced on a real-time basis, and all of it eventually will be able to be bookable in an absolutely delightfully smooth way. So it'll take quite a few cats to put that together.
Cats with apps. You have sort of said that you want to be the Amazon of whatever Uber delivers, right? You want to not just be a bookseller or a car ride seller, but want to have a huge amount of platforms and diversity. Is that right?
I think the way that we look at it is we want to be your operating system for everyday city life. Anyway, when you wake up in the morning and you want to go to work, we want to be there. If you want a sandwich for lunch, We want to bring it to you in the evening. If you want to go out, we want to be there. We want to provide you a bike ride, et cetera. So we're going much broader than the core rideshare business that we started with. And what I talk to the team about is rideshare to us is what books were to Amazon. No one thinks about Amazon as a bookseller. And I think hopefully no one will think about Uber as just a rideshare company going forward.
So back to that, are you crazy? Why are you taking this job on? What did you think? I mean, did you take it with gusto? Were you slightly concerned about coming into this snake pit?
Listen, I was more than slightly concerned. But the advice that I give to young people is, and I'm no longer a part of that group, unfortunately, is look to go to a place where you can make a difference, but look especially to go to a place that's making a difference in the world.
So how do you think you've made a difference, for instance, in the safety realm, in in the areas that had a lot of negative publicity before?
Well, Uber now, what's different about Uber as a digital company is that we are, to some extent, digitizing the physical world. And the physical world comes with all kinds of complications, including every day, 17 million times a day, two people get in the car and go someplace. And the one in a million chance for us happens 17 times every single day. So we do take safety, for example, making sure that those two interactions are delightful interactions, friendly interactions, sometimes quiet interactions, but most importantly, safe interactions is something that we take incredibly seriously. And it's something actually that technology can help in. So, for example, we have made safety a top priority for the company for the past 2 years, and we've introduced features like 911 integration right into your app. It's available here. It's available in London. You can push a button. The information about your car, about your location, which we have, automatically goes into 911, so the response time can be incredibly quickly. We have telematics now, Check Your Ride, where if we sense something wrong with the ride, is there a sudden stop? Is there a pause? We know where you're supposed to go to. We know how long it's going to take. If it's taking 20 minutes longer than it should, we actually contact you. Christian, are you okay? Is there anything going on? Just to make sure that you are safe. And by the way, the same thing occurs for drivers too. Make sure the driver is safe. Both the driver and the rider are contacted. We have a feature now I use with my daughter who's in college right now, which is Share Your Ride, where you can share your ride with someone else so that your loved one knows that you're safe, knows where you are, and knows that you've arrived as well. These are all a set of features that we're continuing to iterate on the safety front. And ultimately, my goal is simple. I want to be the safest transportation platform on Earth. I think we're getting there, but we have more work to do.
You just talked earlier about workers' rights and how you treat yours like human beings. What about just phasing out drivers? I mean, I know you have a massive driverless car program. You're doing many, many test runs,
yes,
all the rest
yes.
of it. No more drivers?
No, we're going to have drivers for a long time. I think we're going to have drivers for a long time. The drama that the press loves to talk about is machines replacing humans. Okay, but the reality is the better thing than humans alone and machines alone are machines and humans working together. So I believe that the driverless effect on society, on driving in general, is going to be that driverless will very slowly replace the very simple routes, the easiest routes, no left turn, the repetitive routes, the predictable routes, right? Humans shouldn't be doing repetitive, predictable, simple tasks. We should leave that to the machines. So our approach to driverless is going to be, we know what are the routes that are challenging, difficult, that humans should continue to drive. And there will be a subset of routes that machines can complete as well. So ultimately, machines and humans are going to work together to create an Uber service that's better than the Uber that you have today.
Let me ask you a little bit about your personal background. Like me, you are Iranian.
Yes. We still call ourselves Iranian.
Even though
we're American citizens, or I don't
well,
know, you're
Iranian British.
British,
you're yeah. Iranian American.
Yes.
Okay, so you're Iranian American. How much did that shape your drive? How much did it shape how you have performed here in your adopted country?
Well, when we left Iran as a family, we lost everything. It was all gone.
After the revolution.
After the revolution. We had to escape here. We always had family. And for me, that ever-present, always having family to be there for you has been a huge part of my persona. Uber gets put aside here when I get together with my family, and it's all about my mom's cooking, right?
Yep.
That's the most important
that.
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that in losing everything, there was absolutely a desire, myself, my brothers, my extended family, to rebuild. And we were lucky enough to come to a country. We were lucky enough to come during a time when immigrants were welcome. And we were determined to rebuild. It wasn't a top-down thing. We just knew it. And if you look at my brothers, my cousins, the extended family, we've really worked hard. All of us are very accomplished. And that intense kind of determination to rebuild in this incredible country has been something that's driven me. It's driven the rest of my family. And you know, we came here at the right time. We've been very lucky.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Several times you've talked about the time in which you came here and how lucky you were. Obviously, it's not like that right now. Particularly Iranians and other people from Muslim countries are under a lot of scrutiny, a lot of bans, a lot of legislation or just executive action from the president. How do you feel about that now? Because Iran, even when you came over, it was the hostage crisis. Iran has always been, you know, looked at as very suspect, if not the enemy. How do you live this moment right now with specific targeting?
Yeah, I think for me, I do my best to speak the immigrant creed that we are all a nation of immigrants here and represented. I think it also relates to my work. A significant number of Uber drivers are immigrants. So this is something that actually the immigrant voice is a voice that I can speak to individually, but it's also a voice for the company. So for me, the personal and the company and the interest of our drivers coming together is something that that's terrific. And ultimately, you know, this is immigration in this country has been an incredibly positive force. The many, many immigrants are running very important, or sons or daughters of immigrants are running very, very important companies here. And I think that as long as we do the right thing, then the reality that, hey, you know what, these are people just like anyone else, and they're constructive and they're adding to society, that voice will get louder than any one individual voice demonizing immigrants.
Dara Khosrowshahi, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So a candid conversation with the head of Uber, pledging to reform a company that has actually revolutionized part of the American and the global economy. Our next guest has made his career confronting dangerous situations. British director Orlando von Eisendel is best known for White Helmets, his Oscar-winning documentary about the rescue workers who put their lives on the line to save civilians amid the war in Syria. But in his latest Netflix film, he turns the camera on himself. Evelyn is named after his brother who took his own life 14 years ago. It's a moving portrait that looks at a family dealing with loss and grief. Here's a clip from the trailer.
He was saying, like, I'm going to kill myself, like, all the time.
Maybe I could have said something that would have meant he didn't do that.
It's the legacy of what happened and how all of our relationships have been fractured.
No! I'm sorry, I'm not chilling out.
Stop it.
If you don't open up completely, how are you going to feel later on?
So suicide and mental health are real issues for our time. And Orlando told our Hari Srinivasan why, despite the perilous locations of his previous films, this was his most challenging yet.
Orlando, you've faced armed militias in the Congo. You've, you know, run into the rubble with the White Helmets in Syria. And then your producing partner says, how about a film about your family? What is the story that hadn't been discussed?
So when Joanna Natsagawa, my producing partner, she said that, it was like a punch to my stomach. We've known each other for 7 odd years. And in that entire time, I'd never had a conversation with her about what happened to my brother. And she knew that something had happened. She probably knew he took his own life, but we'd just never spoken about it. So for her to suggest one day, would I consider making a film about Evelyn and the family? I was almost furious, because to me it looked like it'd come out of the blue. From her perspective, in making all these really difficult films, she'd picked up on something that a lot of the crew would go away and cry at the end of the day after witnessing something really traumatic. And she just never seen me really get upset in that way. And she's very perceptive, and I guess had thought there's some block in me that, you know, and it's probably to do with my brother. And so after initially getting really upset with her, I started to interpret how could I be angry that she's just asked this question, that there really is something that maybe I should look at. And the other weird thing is, Hari, the day she said this to me, it was the anniversary of my brother's death. And there's just, there's no way she could have known that. It was like there was a sign that this was the right time to maybe look at this.
You say his name really for almost 10 years.
You know, it's just weird. It just becomes your new normal. The normal is to not think about him. And I just thought, if I ever really go there, it's so upsetting. It's so tough to deal with. I don't want to. Life's going on, and I'm doing other things, and I'm immersing myself in other people's problems, so I don't have to ever really address my own.
So compare these, like the physical threat and danger that you put yourself into in some of your projects, versus really kind of an emotional threat and danger that you're putting yourself. What's harder?
Well, I mean, this is going to sound so strange. I found making this film probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And it's weird. Physical fear is yes, it's very scary, and I'm used to being scared in my life a lot. But looking inwards, I don't know. I found that so much more terrifying.
Now, for people who haven't seen the film, tell us a bit about your brother. What was he like? I mean, we learned little bits from home videos that you include in the documentary, but who is he?
So, Evelyn, he was a gentle, a very gentle boy. I shared a room with him for most of my life. And he loved the outdoors. He loved walking. He loved camping, which is part of the reason that we did this in the film. We went on this big walk to all of the places where he'd love to go when he was alive. And then towards just as he started university, he was studying to be a doctor, and he just started to spiral downhill. His life started to unravel. He got depressed. He dropped out of college, and eventually was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And just one day, I mean, sadly for all of us, it seemed like he was on a turn that was going better. And just in that moment, he decided he didn't want to live anymore.
Your family, they all agreed to this? Oh, yeah, by the way, remember our brother, and let's go on walks and talk about the one thing that we really haven't talked about.
I sort of felt it would never actually really have to happen. I'd never really have to go through it, because there's no way my family would agree to do it. And the strange thing was, one by one, after talking to them, they all said, no, we'd love to do it. It was...
And there you're stuck now.
Yeah, well, then I was like, what do you mean you want to do it? I think for them, this was... They'd been waiting, especially my brother and sister, they'd been waiting for an opportunity to have this conversation. And I guess maybe they've been waiting for me to sort of catalyze it.
Now let's take a look at one of the clips with the three of you and your mom on a walk.
When I sometimes think of him deeply, there are 6 points that come into my head that I don't try and think of, but they come towards me. One is, he used to whisper in your ear.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. The other one was his giggle.
Yeah.
The other were his twinkling eyes.
Yeah.
The other one was, he had the loudest farts.
I was about to say that!
Mum, I can't believe that's one of your memories, because that's also... I actually don't remember the loudness. I remember the smell.
Yeah.
It's... But that would, if you were to ask me sort of 10 things, I definitely would have listed that as one of them.
Yeah. You said he had a diagnosis of schizophrenia. I mean, it's a disease. But were you angry?
after he did it, I was furious because, and you know, the sad bit is, and this is one of my regrets, is I was angry a lot of the time when he was ill because, of course, when anyone's ill, all family attention and resources go into that. And I felt that was, I sometimes felt it was selfish because, you know, there was four of us as kids and suddenly almost 100% of my mum's time and energy was on Evelyn. I didn't really understand that. I thought maybe he was being selfish and self-centred. And, you know, it's only in hindsight that I realised that that's a ridiculous view. He was ill.
Then you realise to yourself, wow, what kind of person am I to think about this, right?
I have to say, it takes a while for that to come out because when he actually took his life, actually the anger was even more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes, that needs to subside and then you start to feel really sorry for him and the pain that he must have been going through. And then shame and then grief. I don't necessarily know exactly how it is in the US. In the UK, suicide is still so taboo, which is partly one of the reasons this was so hard to talk about.
The number one killer of men under 45 in the UK.
Yeah.
That's a stunning statistic. Why do you think that is?
Lots of reasons. I mean, I think, you know, and this is something I really learned about myself. I think I thought I'm a modern man in touch with my emotions, you know, and in doing this, I realized that I associated being open and emotional with a sign of weakness. And that a lot of men feel that, you know, so when people are ill, they have mental health problems, they don't often go and seek help. They don't talk to people because it's embarrassing. And therefore they suffer in silence and they don't reach out. And it's in talking to other people and seeking help that you can break that pattern that might eventually lead to suicide.
There are several points in the film where each kind of character, if you will, struggles. And there's a part I remember where your sister is in a car and she's crying and she's saying, you know what, I thought these walks, it would all be over. I thought she was looking for a finality. There isn't one. I mean, he's gone for the rest of your lives. And you have to live with that emptiness.
I think going into this, I had a slightly naive Hollywood idea of how this all might work. We'd go on this walk, we'd talk about this thing that none of us could face, and then we'd all be healed and live happily ever after. And the reality is that that's really naive. That's not how grief works. The reality is that we went on this, we did talk, and we all built a relationship with Evelyn again. You know, that's something that I've taken away, I've cherished. I went from nothing, I'd not even been able to think about him, to being able to talk openly about him and remember all the good times that we spent together. So that, but in terms of the day it finished and feeling healed, no, it's an ongoing process. And that scene with my sister was recognition of that, that at the end of this, she was saying, this isn't all better, but there is progress.
Yeah, there's a scene of some of the progress when you all are walking. Let's take a look.
Yeah, oh, I don't know.
I thought I'd kind of put all these feelings to bed. And I just want to keep
you my... You are. You have been.
Who's Leon? What did he mean to your brother? Where's their relationship?
So Leon went to school with Evelyn, and they were best friends. They used to do training, you know, like athletics training together, and I think that's what they bonded over. And then since Ethan died, I've become close to Leon, and he's one of my best friends. So it felt he obviously had to come on this walk and join us. And he was so generous. I think he'd found his own way to deal with Ethan's death, but I think he came on this walk to help us deal with it.
How do we get to the point where here you are on these walks, and it's an incredibly intimate kind of portrayal because the camera's right here. It's almost like we're walking with you. And it's almost natural where people just stop and they have these moments.
Well, walking's this extraordinary thing that for some reason allows you to have these really difficult conversations in this very amazing way. You know, you're asking me this question now, it's very intense. I have to answer. I'm looking directly at you. But when you're walking, you're not looking someone in the eye. You're looking, someone might ask you a question and you can answer in bits. You can pause, you can breathe, you can look at the view. And it just creates this forum for really open conversations. And so what you see in the film is you there are these very open conversations, and then it just gets too much every now and again, and somebody stops and they just want to cry, they want to hug, and that's what you see in that moment.
And Leon's also just dealing with the survivor's guilt. I mean, you see in a different part of the film, if I had gotten that phone call, if I didn't let it go to voicemail, could I have been the man that saved my friend's life?
I think all of us, and I think anyone that's experienced suicide in their life, I think everyone racks their brains for that moment. Was there a moment where if I'd have done something, you know, could I have stopped it? You know, I was on holiday when I got the phone call that Ethan had died, and I, of course, thought, well, if I wasn't on holiday, if I'd have been at home, could I have stopped
it? It's your fault.
It's my fault, yeah, and you live with that.
How could you have not seen it coming? What kind of brother are you?
Precisely. And everyone lives with that who's been touched by this.
Your mother at one point said something about her being a single mom and raising you all. And here he is, the son is schizophrenic. And she was carrying this weight. Will other people perceive me as the source of the problem? I mean, it's just a huge effect. It's not just that one individual.
I guess I'd say two things. I think the first is, on the surface, it looks like a very selfish act. I think for the person that's actually doing it,
right,
to them, it's a selfless act because
right.
They've got to a point in their lives where they believe they're a burden on everybody and the world would be better off without them.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot tell anyone who's watching this, who might be thinking that how wrong that is. And this film is testimony to what the devastation is, that 13 years later, a family can't even talk about this person because of the grief that they're carrying. I actually, one of the legacies, one of the things that has touched all of us behind this film so much is all the letters that we've received from people who've said this very thing. They've said, I watched the film and I've struggled with suicidal thoughts for a long time and I now don't think I could ever go through with it because I've seen the damage it will do. And that for us is incredible to hear.
You know, what's strange is, or maybe it shouldn't be so strange considering the prevalence of suicide in the UK, but you're walking along this and you're deciding to share with people why you're walking. And it's literally the ice cream man that you stop at shares an incredibly personal story with you and a veteran that you meet on the walk. I mean, it goes, we're watching the entirety of that conversation and it goes from zero to very deep in 30 seconds.
So this is something that is probably one of the things I've taken away most from this is that there is this extraordinary thing about if you're open, emotionally honest and vulnerable, it's almost contagious. So people would see the cameras and they'd say, what are you doing? And we'd explain that we're doing this walk in memory of our brother who took his own life. And people would just suddenly open up completely and say, well, that happened to my mum. That happened to my sister. And we'd have these extraordinary conversations with complete strangers. And it was really beautiful. And in some ways, the film's done that too, that in a lot of the Q&As we do when we show the film in cinemas, at the end of the film, people would just stand up. They wouldn't ask a question. They just share. And it was really beautiful when people would just say, this happened to me, and I just wanted to share it with this room of strangers. And it's extraordinary.
Why is it so hard to talk about?
Life's difficult, and we build these barriers around ourselves, and you know it's easier to not have to go there, and make yourself upset. I built this big shell around myself, and dealt with other things that I guess prevented me from ever needing to deal with my own problems. I can't tell you how liberating it is to actually have these difficult conversations, whatever they might be. It doesn't need to be about mental health or suicide. It might just be, you know, there's all families have issues, and I think if you can find the right forum to have these open conversations, and walking is definitely a good catalyst for that, it feels incredible.
Given that you know what the passing of an individual, the impact that it has on the family, here you are, a guy that's gone into pretty sticky situations. In your next project, or the project after that, does this factor into you that maybe I shouldn't put myself into riskier places because of what will happen?
I've also just had a child.
That will change the equation.
And it already has changed the equation. And even just going away from home is a much harder decision. So there's a balance. You've also got to live your own life. You've got to be true to who you are and what makes you passionate and what contribution you feel that you can make, small contribution you can make to the world. So it's about weighing that up with your family and your responsibilities. So
what are you going to tell your child about their late uncle?
Well, my son, his middle name's Evelyn. So my brother will kind of live on in him.
Orlando, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a really important conversation on grief. And if you or anyone you know needs help, please contact your National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That is it for now. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.